Yes.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Please, I'm going to open it up for your comment in a second. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to Air Quality Control Advisory Council. We're going to start, but there is a sign-up sheet going around, and we sure like to get everyone's name on the sign-up sheet. So find some way before you leave today to enable that and make sure it happens. Today, we're here mainly to have a continuation of our last meeting, which is about control of fuel burning equipment and control of nitrogen oxide emissions from coal-fired electric generating units. And the way we're going to operate, I suggest the way we operate, and I'm asking the council for input. The way we operate is have Tad Abram go over what's happened in the intervening time since the last meeting, and then have a short opportunity for public comment from the people involved. Have a little bit of interaction between the council and those people involved, and then see where we go from there. Does that seem like a good way to operate? Anybody have a difference of opinion? Very quickly, we're going to go around the room and introduce everyone. We're going to start with the council, and then we'll go around the outside. I'm John Quinn. Welcome today.
Tad Abram, Air Director, Maryland Department of the Environment. Glad to have everybody here.
Susan Nash, MDE, Armor Compliance.
Diane Franks, Manager, Air Quality Planning Program.
Sunny Yam, University of Maryland, Baltimore.
Lita Mack, Greenbelt City Council.
Lauren Gerritsen, representing the Children's Environmental Health and Protection Advisory Committee.
Kevin Barnabo, representing Maryland Association of Counties.
Taisha Soto, MDE.
Randy Mosier, Regulations Development Division of MDE.
Hussein Vahid, Regulation Development.
Paul Salowich, University of Maryland, College Park.
Larry Schoen, Schoen Engineering for American Society of Mechanical Engineers.
John Kuhn, representing the American Institute of Chemical Engineers.
Kip Keenan, Northrop Grumman Corporation, representing the Chamber of Commerce and Manufacturing Industry.
And if we could start here and do your best is to go around the table right here, Mr. Chairman.
David Smedic with the Sierra Club.
Josh Berman with the Sierra Club.
Real loud, everybody.
Clara Summers with Interfaith Power and Light.
Lori Wilmot, Sierra Club.
Cindy Elliott, Sierra Club.
Jennifer Quincy, Sierra Club.
Maureen O'Connor, Sierra Club.
Andrew Barnett, Sierra Club.
Carolyn Jones, MDE, Regulation Development.
Barry Mullen, Baltimore City resident, and I live in Brooklyn, Curtis Bay area.
Kevin Grisher, Sierra Club.
Susan Allen, I live in Dunbar, not a concerned citizen.
Martin Lichten, concerned citizen, living in Baltimore County.
Rebecca DeLott, Baltimore, New York. Bobby Hales, Quiet Sierra Club, Howard County Climate Change.
Barbara Christensen, Howard County Climate Change, I'm Sierra Club.
Simi Yao, Stephen and I, University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
Bill Fisher, student at University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
Daniela Beal, concerned citizen in Baltimore City.
Linda Kangaroo, Sierra Club, Coco Climate Change.
Chris Yoder, Sierra Club, but more importantly, grandparent.
You're here.
I'm Alan Anderson, Austria, I'm a landscape architect and concerned citizen.
I'm Doris Toews, Sierra Club and concerned citizen.
Leah Kelly, Environmental Integrity Project.
Sharon Boyer, and I'm a concerned citizen for clean air.
Regina Minnis, Baltimore, Maryland, concerned citizen.
Jerry Brubach, Carroll County, concerned citizen.
Bob Jacobson, Pikesville, Baltimore County, SCR.
George Alderson, Cadenceville, retiree from U.S. EPA.
Brother Jerry O'Leary, coordinator of Justice and Peace for the Sumerian Brothers that we have supported the Department.
Richard Reese, Sierra Club. I'm also an engineer.
Stephanie Sow, Air Quality Reporter, Argus Media.
Catherine Winnis, Maryland Department of the Environment.
Wayne King, Maryland Department of the Environment.
Carl Munger, Maryland Department of the Environment.
Environment.
Ian Villavieca, State Police.
John Artis, Maryland Department of the Environment.
Steve Lane, Maryland Department of the Environment.
Ken Buck,
Roger Fennell, Maryland Department of the Environment.
Josh Tolman, Sierra Club.
Mark Shepard, come back for a minute.
Michael Powell, speaking today.
Deborah Roger, Cooper Raven.
Tom Leisinger, Raven Power.
Todd Chasen for Raven.
Kyle Seacrest with NRG.
David Neal with NRG.
Walter Stone with NRG Energy.
Dave Kramer with NRG.
Steve Arabia with NRG.
Gene Trisco for American Coalition.
Thanks. I think we got everyone, and thanks for being so brief and getting through. Anybody not introduce themselves? So turn it over to Tad, and then I'm giving an overview of what's happened since the first part of this meeting, correct? Good?
Is there anybody on the phone?
Oh, thank you. Is there someone on the phone?
Anybody on the phone that that needs to introduce themselves? Now, is there anybody on the phone that needs to introduce themselves?
Hi, good morning. John Ryman, AES Corporation.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good. Good morning.
Dr. Salwich reminded me I hadn't approved last time's minutes. Has everyone had a chance to look at the minutes from the last meeting? You have a copy in front of you. I'll give you about 30 seconds in case, just to refresh your memory if you've looked at them. I'll entertain a motion to accept.
I'd like to suggest an amendment. There's a sentence that reads, the council commented that other regulations by EPA may affect the ability of the affected units to continue to operate. I'd like to amend that to state, the council commented that economic factors, as well as other regulations, because I certainly remember talking about the economic factors driving the transition to gas.
I think that's a great comment. Could you point everyone to the page and about the paragraph?
Page 5 of 6, and the paragraph begins, the council commented that. So the suggestion is to write economic factors as well as.
Everyone just nod their head in agreement with that change?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Nice change. Any other changes suggested? So I'll entertain a motion to accept the minutes as amended.
So moved.
Need a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. The minutes are accepted, and now we'll go right to Mr. Ahern.
So as I'm going through a quick overview, we're not doing a lengthy overview like we did last time. This is a quick overview. Make sure that everybody who wants to speak is in John's hands, because while I'm up here doing this piece, John's going to be figuring out how to handle the public comment part of this meeting. So I find it very interesting. So the environmental community sort of went to the right. Private sector
it's our left.
To the left. And most of my staff are somewhere in the middle. So I found it interesting. Anyway, Josh, I give you credit. You were over here.
I have switched sides.
Thank you all for being here. As the crowd indicates, it's an important meeting. And I am not going to go through an hour presentation like I did last time. We have that available if folks want to go back through the details on how different pieces work. But our purpose today is pretty simple. And I'll go through what we've been doing and where we ended up. Cover 4 quick topics, sort of a recap of what we've been doing over the past month. And then a brief overview just of some of the key changes that MDE is recommending to ACT Act to move ahead with. short section on some of the critical issues that we're hoping that we've addressed with the changes to the regulation, and then just the next step schedule moving forward. A recap, most folks were here for the September 8th ACAC meeting. It was a very lengthy meeting, had a tremendous amount of public input on our proposal. And the action was that ACAC asked us to move forward with the reg, but also asked us to take about a month to work out a few issues if we could work them out with key stakeholders. This meeting was scheduled during that September 8th meeting, and we've worked very hard with key stakeholders for the past month. That process is now completed. What we'd like ACAC to do today is to reaffirm their earlier approval to move forward with the regulation with the changes that are in the draft reg that everybody got middle of last week. And I'll walk through the key changes. It was a very intense process. If I had a lot of money and more time, I would have hired a third-party facilitator. But it was a very good process. I really appreciate the level of effort everybody put into it. Not only the folks sort of tough talking about the big policy pieces, but a lot of really intense work on some technical issues as well. The three key stakeholder groups we met with were Energy, Raven Power, and Sierra Club. We had four face-to-face meetings on September 10th, 17th, 22nd, and 30th. I think the shortest was a two-hour meeting. I think some of them actually approached 4 hours. So it was a very good, intense process. And I really appreciate everybody's effort. Outside of the face-to-face meetings, I think I was at least involved in 30 or 40 calls with individual companies or with Sierra Club, and my staff had some technical discussions as well. So it was a very intense process. And where we ended up, the draft of the regulation that you have in your hands today is supported by MBE and two of the three key stakeholder groups. So you will be hearing from folks not only about their support, but about any additional concerns they may have. Just a reminder, we had this intense one-month process, but we have literally been working on this regulation with stakeholders for almost 2 years. And so there's no topic that hasn't been brought up and discussed, and it's been a very good process, but it's been very lengthy. So you may recognize this slide. I used this slide last month as sort of an overview, and then we talked in more detail about the three steps. But the reg is really pretty straightforward in terms of how it's set up. It has two phases and then three steps. Two steps in phase one and one step in phase two. So in phase one, which is actually not controversial at all, there's sort of consensus on how to make phase one work. First step is we have to minimize emissions using existing technologies each day of the summer. Last meeting, I went through the interesting things that have happened over the past few years as the energy market has changed, and coal units have become lower capacity. Folks found themselves in situations where they could meet regulatory requirements but not run their controls on the days when we actually needed the controls the most. So the first step is to fix that. You must run your controls and run them really well each day of the ozone season. Second step is sort of complements that. It sets a system-wide rate that's an indicator for good performance. It's a more mathematical way to ensure that we have good performance. They're both fairly straightforward. We had some amendments on some of the technical pieces to those. I'll talk about them a little bit. But phase one was pretty much, I think we had full agreement with your later folks, but not controversial. Phase two was the more difficult piece of this. It's where we basically say that, remember the PowerPoint last time? We showed that we now find that our smallest sources who only operate on just the days when electricity is needed the most now have our highest emissions. So phase two focuses on deeper reductions at those units, smaller units, lower capacity units, less economically healthy units, and they're listed here. Crane 1 and 2, Wagner 2, Chalk Point 2, and the three units at the Dickerson plant. So phase two, and I'll go through this in a minute in more detail, but it basically says we need to see deeper reductions at a later date. Folks are looking. One of the big trade-offs was a trade-off to 2020, so I'll go through that in a minute. But the other piece we tried to build into phase two was flexibility. We wanted to give the companies a lot of flexibility in terms of how they got to the decision on deeper reductions, and I'll go through that. Again, the major changes, we do have some substantive, technical, numerical changes to some of the numbers in step one of phase one, and I'll show you those in a minute. We have some substantive changes to phase two, both some technical changes and some changes to the structure of how we're providing the flexibility to make sure we get those deeper reductions at a later date. And I will walk through both of those. So here is the substantive technical changes to phase one. Pretty straightforward. Regulation 0382 is where we say run your controls in the summertime, minimize emissions by optimizing the use of technologies. And it sets up a process where there are numerical limits. And there's a presumption that if you're below the numerical limits, then that's an indicator of good performance. But if you're above the numerical limits, then you have to provide a report that explains why you were above the limits. And there are situations where startup, shutdown, low capacity, where they're going to have difficulty meeting these screens. So the first set of changes was to, does that show up? Green is always a difficult piece to see.
Yeah, pretty hard.
Let me go back then. First changes is to these 24-hour block limits that folks have to use to show that they're running their control technology well each day of the summertime. So the first change was to Brandon Shore's Unit 2. No change to Unit 1. And what we ended up doing, after much technical discussion with the company, with Sierra Club, with us, hard to see, but the old limit was 0.08, and the design of this particular unit is very interesting, and so it has this issue where when it operates normally in this range, it can get pretty low levels, but then it has a design issue where once you get above this number, you need. So that we ended up breaking it down into two screens, and I think there was unanimous support for that change. Can folks see it through the green?
Yeah.
Second change was at Chalk Point, Unit 2, and no change to Unit 1, and the number was bumped from 0.3 pounds per million BTU. To 0.33. Again, technical data submitted by the company. We all talked it through. This did seem to be a better way to screen that particular source.
Yeah, it might be better if you just highlight it by just pointing out rather than put the green behind it.
I agree, the green is tough. So this is the second change, 0.3 to 0.33. Now, Chalk Point, both units discharge through a single stack. So when Unit 2 is running only, this is the change. And when Unit 1 and 2 are both running, this is the screen. Again, these were fairly technical, and I think that the stakeholders that worked with us concurred with these changes. The final change is at Wagner 2. Unit 2, no change at Unit 3. And it's a switch from 0.25 up to a new level of 0.34. So these are all technical changes, data submitted by the sources, review of the data. I think there's unanimous support for these changes to this piece of the rule.
Can I just take just a...
Sure.
I don't want to get into discussion, but could you just explain why that unit, Wagner 2, has such a higher number and needs such an increase? What's so different about its controls?
Well, it really had to do with the availability of the data on which to base this number. And I don't think we had, we had some historical data. The company brought newer data, particularly from a summer study this year. And after reviewing that data, we did agree that 0.34 is a better way to screen that particular unit. It really was not changes, it was just the availability of the data. There was some brand new data that came out of a summer study in 2014. And again, we went through all of this with all of the stakeholders. So I think everybody's pretty comfortable with this.
But presumably they don't have SCR there.
No, so Wagner 2 does not have the SCR.
So I think Larry was saying, what do they have that's different?
They have an SNC. Oh, I'm sorry, that's your question. So yeah, you can look at this and you can sort of see the units that have the SCRs. The units with the SCRs are the 0.08s, the 0.07s, the 0.07s, the 0.07s. The units with the SNCRs, or a technology called an SACR, select auto-cathode. You can see the 0.3s, 0.28s, 0.3s, 0.2s, 0.34s. So that, yeah, there's a real difference in the rate when you're controlled with an SCR and when you're controlled with an SNCR. And this is phase one, and I'll talk about how these rates have to change over time. So the second major change had to do with regulation 04. This is where deeper reductions are required. Again, it focuses on those units that don't have the state-of-the-art controls. And this is where actually most of the discussion and debate took place around this particular piece of this rule. The original proposal we brought forward to ACAC on September 8th had four options to comply with the requirement. I'll go through those in a second. The final one eliminates one of those options, but it does extend the compliance timeline for 2 years to 2020. So you might, there's a trade-off in here for more certainty, but more time as well. And I'll go through that in a second. We do have support, we believe, from two of the three key stakeholder groups on this change to the regulation. And again, we spent a whole lot of time trying to figure out how to make option 4, which was the most flexible piece of regulation 04, we tried to figure out how to make it work. I think at the last meeting you heard folks, a lot of the comments were on that piece and the need for certainty about how you're going to make sure that it's a strong enough way to get to the goal in regulation 04. And we simply just could not reach consensus. Even though I think we worked on it till the very last day, we just could not get there. And so we had an option that said, let's stick with three options instead of four, and that's where we landed. So let me go through the change in a little bit more detail. This is the most controversial part of the rule. Not a lot of language. And as a refresher, what it basically said when we brought it to on September 8th is that sources had four choices. By June 1, 2018, they had four options. Option one was install selective catalytic reduction technology, and that technology was to meet a 0.07 pound per million BTU rate. Second option was to retire the unit. Third option was to move to natural gas. And then there was this flexible fourth option, which said the company could could generate a case-by-case alternative plan, but the plan had to get reductions. Consistent with SCR controls and historical operations. This was the most controversial part of it. So where we landed, first big change was the dates were moved to 2020. 2018 was the original date. It's now moved to 2020. Second big change, and you heard a lot of comment on this, was to say that if you are going to install an SCR technology, the original rule said it's a piece of technology that has to be capable of meeting a 0.07 pound per million BTU limit. After much discussion, we agreed to that 0.09 was there's a big difference between the guarantee you get and the way it operates. We have units that have guarantees that are much higher than the way they operate. So even though it says 0.09, in the real world, I think we'll see a lot lower rates from units if they install the SCRs. Third big change was this whole fourth option was eliminated. Again, it was another way to try to provide flexibility. It allowed for a case-by-case plan to be submitted by the source. There was a lot of discussion about how to make sure that the case-by-case plan got the reductions that were needed. And after much discussion, we ended up deciding just to drop that fourth option. There are other changes, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them today. I view them as less substantive, more technical, more regulatory. There were some changes to the definition of system operating day. It has to do with how you do 30-day system-wide averaging. There were some clarifications of the plan requirements. You have to have a plan that shows how you're going to make sure that you optimize your technologies to minimize emissions each day. So there's some changes, clarifying changes to that definition. There are several spots where we've now included EPA. When there's an approval to be done by MDE on a plan, we've now included EPA as part of that approval process. Some clarifications on, with some of the changes, the compliance processes for the 0.0382 run the technologies all summer piece. And then there are miscellaneous clarifications and cleanups, but the two big issues were the ones that I highlighted. Some of the key issues that that we talked about as part of this lengthy, intense stakeholder process, and I'll go through each one of these in a little bit more detail, sort of the big four themes we tried to make sure we always kept in mind. Ensuring public health protection. First and foremost, we do have one of the toughest ozone problems in the East. We do still record very high ozone, even though we've seen huge progress. We went through that at the last meeting. Again, it's a serious health issue. Asthma, other respiratory distress, early mortality, and children and the elderly are particularly sensitive. So it is a very important public health issue. And the way this rule works is the phased reductions do two things. They help us immediately get into compliance with the current standard, but there's a new standard on the horizon. Near unanimous support from the academic community that lower ozone levels are needed. And so this will also help us move in the direction of protecting public health and meeting future standards as well. And we're working on an ozone plan. We owe it next June. And this will be one of the three largest contributing pieces of that plan. The other two really large contributing pieces are the federal Tier 3 mobile source tailpipe standards and fuels. That's a huge benefit to us. And then the other big benefit is the work we're doing trying to drive contribution from upwind power plants to be minimized. Second big piece, I mentioned this earlier, the way the market has shifted over the past few years and this sort of unexpected situation we found where sources weren't required to run their control technologies and optimize their use on the days when they were needed the most. This isn't unique to Maryland. This is happening across a lot of the East. That was a big issue, and we needed to fix that. So this rule does fix that issue. again, I think there was near unanimous support for this piece. That's important. This step was one where there was nearly full support by everyone. Consistency with other states. My guess is in the comment period you will hear that Maryland is lagging far behind other states, and you will also hear that Maryland is pushing harder than any other state around. From my perspective, we've done a very good job in Maryland, but we did have some catching up to do with a couple other states like Delaware, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Wisconsin, particularly on the piece of making sure you run your control technology each day and focusing on these units that are high emitters but low capacity peak day units. So this will make us much more consistent with those states that have already taken that step. Pennsylvania, who we're often compared to, does have a rule out. It is less stringent than what we're talking about today, but it is also something that is of great interest to many people, and there's probably a few folks in the room who are already working on their challenge to the Pennsylvania proposal. So we do think that this rule will bring us up to snuff with the other states that have gone to this step. Finally, the last issue, which is really the toughest one we struggled with, which is how to provide the flexibility. And one of the key things we did was add timing. So this was really at the heart of our inability to fix the fourth option in Regulation 04. But we really were trying to figure out a way to give companies many options to look at and time to make sure that they look at all the options and that retirement is an option, but is sort of the last option. So we really worked hard on this piece. And again, the 2020 extension, that's a long time, is what we're hoping provides companies with the flexibility they need to do the research they need to do, to figure out how they're going to modernize certain pieces of their plants, and to move forward without plant shutdowns. And again, we have an older fleet in Maryland. Many of the units we're talking about were built, 50 years ago. So there's been a lot of modernization, but there's sort of a constant need to do that. So, and we do think that all of the units that don't have the state-of-the-art controls have been and continue to look at these options. I think every single unit has looked at switching to natural gas and adding the SCR technology, and it is a changing energy market. And just as an example, just 2 years ago in 2012, the Chalk Point Unit 2 in the Dickerson plant was announcing a plan to move forward with SCRs. Now that has changed, but that's how dynamic the changes are in the energy market right now. So there's a lot that's going to happen over the next 5 years. And again, we do work very closely with our sources, and we know that pretty much everybody is looking at natural gas. It's been an interesting phenomenon over the past few years. The costs have been low. Will it stay low? We're all waiting to see. But we know folks are looking at natural gas as an option at all their plants. And again, probably the biggest compromise in this is this 2020 piece. I would have much preferred to keep it at 2018. But as part of a compromise to give everybody the time they need to make the decisions they need to make, we agreed that we could move forward and do it this way with that extension to 2020. And that's it. This is our schedule. This is really the same schedule we showed earlier. We'd like to have ACAC confirm their earlier recommendation that we move ahead today. Then we want to get it busy with our process, get it proposed and effective in the early 2015 timeframe. And if we succeed with that, we'll start to see the reductions from the reg as early as the spring of 2015. And that's all I have today. A little shorter, longer than I thought it would be. But John, if you wanted to take questions, I can do that.
Yeah, so I'd like to limit it to the council. Council, any questions for Tad? Any comments?
Ted, in terms of meeting the department's obligations for the revised NOx RACT and the 2015 SIP, have you had to make offsetting changes in other aspects of those plans to deal with these changes here?
I think we are going to have to do that. I think it's going to make our job of getting an acceptable SIP in for 2018 a little more difficult, but I think we're still in pretty good shape. We get reductions from both phases. So I think it will make it a little more challenging, but we're okay.
More questions, more comments?
Of course.
I'm glad.
The part that was added about if you only operate only one facility, what does that really apply to, and why was that added?
That has to do with, right now our systems are multiple units owned by one owner. And if we had a situation where a unit was sold, it would change the game for certain pieces of the regulation. So we needed a clarification of that piece of the rule.
Well, what's to prevent someone from gaming that, for instance? How much does it relax the requirements?
It doesn't. It would. There are things like the Healthy Air Act caps that continue to constrain emissions at individual units. So we looked at that. We do not think it in any way affects the stringency of the rule, but it's a clarification we needed because if a company wants to sell a unit, it was a clarification that we had to do.
I don't entirely get it, but let me think about it.
Okay.
So on the long-term rule, we've relaxed the 0.07 to 0.09. And what does that somehow open the door to the selective operation of the controls, kind of like we're having now, where people are not operating it because they're meeting targets?
No, I mean, it's a two-piece requirement. The first one is you have to add the SCR. You
right.
have to add it. And then the second piece is it has to be good enough to be able to meet a 0.09 limit. And then you have the 0.382 requirement that says you have to run it every day, no matter what.
Okay.
So they all work together.
All right. Well, I mean, I don't want to get into lengthy discussion, but to me, I don't think there are any surprises in the regulated industry about this change coming. So I don't personally see the need to relax the 2018 to 2020, but I'm sure we'll have more discussion about that.
Why was the flexibility section taken out of there, where you can have an alternative compliance plan put together that the department would approve?
Yeah, we couldn't agree on the way that you would judge whether that alternative plan was sufficient. We ended up really having a great debate over the end number. I think there was a proposal on the table that said if that plan would meet a 0.08 pound per million BTU 24-hour block average, and it would not include a tonnage cap, that was one option that I think we could have gotten all four participants to agree upon, but we didn't have all four participants agreeing upon it. So we had a lot of debate over, is it 0.08, is it 24-hour block, is it 0.11, is it 30-day rolling average? We just could not reach agreement on how to make sure that alternative plan was good enough. So, and we spent a lot of time on it, right up until 2 hours before the draft of the rule went out to you all. So, Ross.
I just wanted have a brief discussion about the 30-day rolling average versus the 24-hour block. First off, I'm a little confused because there are places in the latest rate where it says 30-day rolling average, but the table has 24-hour block. So it seems like a little bit of a contradiction. I assume that the intent here is that during the first phase, the NOx controls have to be run all the time the plant's operating, and then later on, there has to be the switched SCR or some other technology. I just want to be sure that we're not passing something that has some wiggle room. For example, if a peaking unit comes on, it's only on for 2 days in the month. do you average the other 28 days that it's not on to meet this? Is that something that would be allowed?
That's a great question, but you're going to force me to get complicated. So the rule has multiple averaging periods that serve different purposes. So let's take the first one, which is run your controls every single day and run them well. The rate we use there is a 24-hour block average, because what we want to know is what happened on that day. Did you run that control technology on that day to get to a good rate? And so that's how the 24-hour block average rates are used. Now, we have the 0.15 pound per million BTU number that's part of phase one. And what that is intended to do is it's intended to ensure that a company's system consistently meets good rates and reduces emissions across the ozone season. It's a 30-day rolling average, which basically means, we're looking at the system. So if the unit only runs 2 days in that 30-day rolling average, they don't get to average the zeros in. It's a pound. It's per pound per million BTU of generation. So it's it's a very good point. It's actually one of the issues we went through quite a bit. So, and then the other place where the averaging period comes in is when in phase two, where we say add the new SCR. It says it's got to be an SCR that's good enough to achieve a 0.09 pound per million BTU 30-day rolling average, which is really an indicator for a pretty darn good SCR. Now, when they have it installed, they will then be subject to O3A2, so it will also be subject to a 24-hour block average. So there's multiple ways we use them, but each piece has a different purpose, and actually, in the rule, they all complement each other.
Okay, so there's no wiggle room here if you can't.
I think you will hear in a minute that there's so little wiggle room in this rule that it's going to have consequences that, there's very little wiggle room in here.
Okay.
And the elimination of the fourth piece that was intended to be a very flexible provision where we were going to give folks two more years to figure out maybe an alternative plan, and that is now no longer part of the rule.
And I share Larry's concern about the extra 2 years. I'd like to know what's going to happen between 18 and 20. You know, it's hard to predict that far out in advance, but.
Yeah, it was clearly a compromise. The compromise was certainty for a little bit more time. But maybe some of the folks that are going to comment can talk about the difference between 2018 and 2020.
Which if I might, that we can do that. We'll, after this part's done, we'll talk about how long people, and then while people are up, you can follow up with questions as necessary.
And then I have one more, which is kind of maybe technical or maybe a little more minor, but in 05, what is it? I'm on page 12. So it's 05, what is that, B? Four at the bottom. So you were initially, it's an exceedance of the emissions rates, and you were initially, it was going to be determined by the department to be beyond their control. Then you made it more specific to be startup and shutdown when directed by the grid operator, which I get.
Right.
But the part that I'm uncomfortable is the including but not limited to, which seems to open the door. Without even the department determining, it seems to open the door to almost anything.
Yeah, so a key part of the provision you're looking at is that almost immediately after this rule is adopted, the companies owe us a plan that says, how are we going to use our control technology, how are we going to optimize the use of our control technology to minimize emissions? And so that plan will not be, we're just going to run it. It'll say, when we are running it at design capacity, here are all the bells and whistles that we're going to, this is how we're going to input the cattle, So, but then it's also going to cover, the plan will also cover how you ensure minimized emissions during more difficult periods, startup, shutdown, low capacity operation, and there may be other specific situations. Again, there is an approval to that, MDE approval to that, and an EPA approval to that. But that's how that comes in. And then the piece you're looking at is the piece that sort of indicates how those numbers are used. And so the numbers are used sort of as a presumptive good performance number, but then there's this more difficult test that we have to go through case by case when they're above the numbers. And if it's outside the control of the company, it's not a violation.
Well, but you deleted the part that said beyond the control, and you deleted the part determined by the department. And in its place, you put in, including but not limited to, and then there's a whole list. So when you
and
have
then
a
if
list,
you look, if you look
and
at the end
say,
of that,
but not limited to, that implies lots of other things.
But if you look at the end, we added consistent with the plan.
Provided. Okay, so you just moved the provided.
Yeah, we moved that. So now the limiting ability, it's not open-ended. It has to be included in the plan, which is described earlier. I see your concern.
Okay. I didn't notice. Thank you. I didn't notice it was moved to the end. Okay. Got it.
Like I said, there was a lot of work done over the past month on this role.
Any other comments or questions from the council? Go ahead.
More. Ted, you mentioned there's three key issues with the 2015 SIP. One is this regulation, another is the new tailpipe standards, and the final one is the progress with reductions in upwind states. How dependent is that third issue on the state getting its house in order from the standpoint of being consistent with other mid-Atlantic states?
I think it would be disingenuous for Maryland to be pushing deep power plant reductions on upwind states and not be moving to do the same thing in our own state. So they are very much linked. But I thought you were going to ask, we do have several actions we've taken, but we also have, we are in the midst of some pretty good negotiations with some of the upwind states, and I'm feeling like we're moving closer to having some agreement with upwind states that we will somehow embody in some kind of an agreement, formal federal enforceable agreement, somewhere towards the end of the year. So it's I actually find it very encouraging that we've gotten this dialogue going. But we still have some other actions, like we have a 176A petition. We have a challenge of several SIPs that don't have good neighbor. So those are going on, but right now, because of a lot of things, there's a collaborative effort that's really starting to take off. But this action is linked to that. I mean, it would be difficult for Maryland to be pushing things upwind and not willing to work to reduce emissions close to home.
And, you know, we have this thing from New Jersey while we're talking about other states. Could you just say briefly what the response is? Did New Jersey misunderstand? And we have some of these things covered. This came out October 3rd.
Yeah.
Did you change the reg in some ways? Do you think you disagree with them for some reason?
Yeah, well, they raised concern about the 2020 date.
Okay.
And they raised concern about some other pieces of our fleet. We've talked mostly about this rule, but we are actually working on an analysis of our units that use natural gas and oil, which is another piece they've raised. So I think we're good with the New Jersey comments. I mean, there's nothing we haven't covered in there that, they're very, you all may not remember this, but when we adopted the Healthy Air Act, we did a lot of analysis to show how much it will help Maryland. And it clearly did help Maryland, but because of the way air moves, our Healthy Air Act actually provided greater benefit to New Jersey than Maryland. And so they are very, New Jersey and Delaware are very interested in what we are doing in Maryland. It affects their air quality.
Well, for instance, four, they asked a question that sort of looks a little bit similar to me to Ross's, where they talk about the averaging time, 24 hours versus 30 day. Did they misunderstand, or?
I think they misunderstood that piece. We do have the 24 hour. We actually used the New Jersey and Delaware rules to sort of build that piece. And what one of the harder things that's happened over the past few years is a lot of the coal units have historically been base load units. They were least cost units, and they were often called, and they ran a lot. They ran, all the time. And now that they're competing with natural gas, capacity factors have dropped, and they're not running as much. So they're asked to run they're asked to start up and shut down more, and they're asked to run at low capacity more, and the technologies don't work as well. So that's what we tried to capture. We tried to capture the fact that in the real world, when the units are up and running as they were designed to run, they can meet really low limits, but we also have to acknowledge that the way they're being asked to operate by the grid operators requires us to have a way to minimize emissions for other scenarios as well. So we actually mimic the New Jersey rule.
But a lot of what you said applies to gas, right, about the startup, or no?
Both. I mean, it used to be coal didn't have a lot of this issue.
But not to the, And then item six, they said, please advise if we're mistaken about this at the end of item six.
Here. No, they get the 032 A piece does apply to, that's what I said earlier, even though it's going to be an SCR that's good enough to meet 0.09, once it's installed, it's going to also have to meet the 03A2 requirement to do what you need to do every day to minimize emissions. So they are, they have that right.
Okay. Got it.
We have lots more time for discussion. We're just going to hear more voices. Is it okay if we move on? So just to be better hosts to all of our guests, two things. Some new people have walked in. If we could quickly go around, anyone that's joined since the beginning of the meeting could announce who they are, please.
Sean Gordon, Gordon.
Real loud, please.
Sean Gordon.
Did you get that with a minute? Good.
Tim Whitehouse, Chesapeake Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Anybody else come in? Okay.
Reverend Merrick Moise, Brownsville Energy Commissioner on the Governor's Commission of Environmental Justice and Sustainability.
And John Kenny with the Chesapeake Climate Action Network.
Great. Anyone else? I'm sorry.
Seth Bush, Maryland Sierra Club.
All right. Thanks for taking the time to introduce yourselves. It's important. The other, you have more? Oh, anybody else new on the phone that hasn't introduced themselves?
Yes, Sarah Tomlinson with the Baltimore Metropolitan Council.
Oh, thanks for joining us, Sarah. Sarah's on the council for people.
And this is Darren Lobos from NRDC.
Hi there. Thank you. Two other things. If you look around, there's six exits in case something would happen. A lot of people in this room. No, it's important. Not trying to get rid of anyone. And someone mailed to me, asked me where the restrooms were earlier. They're in the hallway behind that door. You can get there this way or that way to go to the restrooms. And now, this is a question for the council. I have eight people signed up to speak. It seems to me that I was just going to limit it to the parties initially, but eight's not that many. Why don't we let all people speak and give them about three minutes, not counting any questions in their interaction. That kind of keeps us on schedule. So 3 minutes each, and then
maybe you have the principal. I mean, there were three or four principals in this.
And these are all.
Give them a little longer time to do that.
I understand, but there's multiple parties signed up for some of the groups that were involved, and that's. I didn't want to have to broker that. So if we just leave it to 3 minutes, and our questioning could maybe be addressed to one person from that group, something like that. Is that okay? Yeah, it's a good take, but it's only eight. That's why I figured, why not just go with who signed up, let everyone speak. And that doesn't mean other people won't be able to participate. This is just to keep the meeting flowing. I'm going to go in the order that they were given to me, and I'll give the whole order so people can be prepared in their head. I have Walter Stone, Michael Powell, Steve Arabia, David Smedic, Josh Berman, Larry Mullen, Leah Kelly,
and Josh Tolkien, in that order. So if we could have Walter, if you could stand up and identify yourself and try to do something good in 3 minutes.
Before you start the clock, Randy's going to put up a global PowerPoint.
All right.
So thank you very much. I'm Walter Stone with NRG Energy, and I'm here on behalf of two of our subsidiaries that own and operate power plants in Maryland. I want to thank Tad and his colleagues for all the work they've put into this. But as you'll see in a minute from our PowerPoint, we do have a few concerns, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. We do support clean air. We understand the need for tighter NOx regulations. We have been over-compliant since the Healthy Air Act passed. We overbuilt our controls, and we're proud of that. So we're really excited about that. We understand that the NOx regulations should be more stringent, but one of the things we ask that you consider is that it could be the most stringent, but not materially more stringent than what's out there. We do not want to disadvantage Maryland unnecessarily and shift generation, frankly, just to other states that may have less stringent regulations. So the current draft forces technology. It says you got to put on an SCR rather than simply saying hit a number. It eliminates the possibility that someone will invent a widget that's not an SCR. As long as we hit the number, the environment should be neutral as to that. So it removes some of the flexibility that we saw in the first draft. I think I've talked about it being more stringent than other state regulations. So one of the things we urge you to consider is adding back the system averaging that was contemplated by the initial draft. And gives us an opportunity to figure out how to get there in the least cost manner. We understand the reductions are necessary, but let us use our ingenuity to figure out how to get there. So real quickly, we've talked about this, so I'm not going to go over what Ted has already reviewed, but it's like a couple minor tweaks to what's been proposed I think might get us there. One is simply where it says, put on an SCR and hit this number, as you can put an or. Let us figure out how to get to the 0.09, but let us average so that maybe you'll see from the next slide why this is important to us. Similarly, on the very last line where we talked about switching from coal to natural gas, we wanted to open up the possibility that we could switch to some other fuel. It might be biomass, it might be ultra-low sulfur diesel, but we understand that. We urge you to consider that as well. This is the slide I want you to focus on why averaging is so important to us. This is merely an illustration. It's not meant to be any particular set of units, but right now, this is what the rule contemplates. Sets a number, every unit has to hit it. What we're urging you to do is consider this over here on the right side. So if we can figure out a way to over-control if one unit or several units, once again, it should be equivalent. It is equivalent. As an example, let's assume that it's more economic to build a box at one of the plants that does not yet have a control that reduces it by 95% rather than building four little boxes, we build one big box, right? So let's leave open that possibility. Very quickly, the draft regulation today says you got to put on an SCR or do something else, switch to natural gas, shut down. This degrades electrical reliability. One of the benefits of coal is that it is a fuel source that's in your backyard. During the polar vortex, we saw that sometimes natural gas just isn't there. This is important. PJM is looking at this issue. This raises costs to consumers. Ultimately, all these costs flow through the system and back to the ratepayer. It's an important consideration. Not just the ratepayer, but businesses, everyone who buys electricity. Negative economic consequences to Maryland if these units retire or simply are unnecessarily burdened and more expensive than they need to be, that's a bad thing. I think we can all agree on that. So what happens if these units go away? Does that mean people are going to use less electricity? No. It'll be generated somewhere else. It could be in Pennsylvania. It could be in Illinois. Could be in Ohio. So this does not necessarily assure the lowest. This may not be the lowest the path that gets us to the lowest NOx numbers. So once again, what we're asking for over here is let us figure out how to get there, give us a system rate, and let us work through the system. This gets us, this will give us the opportunity to not only figure out the least cost method to get there, but also will give us some credit for the oversized controls we've built and operated to date. This, I think, is the right solution. Any questions from the council? I know I rushed through it very quickly, but in the interest of time, I was trying to get
through. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes?
Doesn't the issue of system-wide averaging run counter to what the department has determined to be one of the major weaknesses of the Healthy Air Act?
So the first phase of the rule, when it says operate your controls well, I think addresses that. And indeed, we have been operating our controls. So I think you may recall when we first started this discussion, Tad put up some slides. We've been operating the SCRs as hard as we can. So, Tad, I don't know if you want to speak to that issue as well.
Well, I think can you put your last piece back up? I mean, to me, the question is that unit 3 on the right hand side, it's a 30-day rolling average. So it's probably only operating on certain days. It's a peaking unit. And I think where we ended up in the debate was that we need to see the peak day reductions from unit 3. And I think if we would have ended up with 0.09 pounds per MMBTU, 24-hour block average, we probably would have had this. But it's the 30-day rolling average piece that that allows some of the low-capacity peaking units without the great technology on them to operate in a way that has high emissions on the days when the ozone is the worst.
Your question's right on target. I think that part of the debate we had was over the averaging period, and the number that I think there would have been agreement on was 0.08 pound per million BTU 24-hour block average. Now, that is a really tough number. Don't get me wrong. That is about as tough as they get. But that was a number that was on the table that we just couldn't get agreement on. So, and again, it's linked directly to the issue you've raised, which is 30-day averaging allows certain units to have higher emissions on days when they don't operate all the time. And, you know, to NRG's credit, I mean, they have one of the best performing units in the East. The Morgantown unit with an SCR routinely meets 0.03.
But that's not an accident. We overbuilt
the
boxes.
Yeah, they did. I'm saying they did a good job. They really get low levels at the Morgantown plant. But the focus of this rule is on the units that have the high peak day emissions, and they are generally the units that are low capacity, high peak day emissions, and in all honesty, they're the most economically struggling units. So
the department is more concerned rather than the mass loading of emissions, they're more concerned about the acute, instantaneous, daily emissions that would cause and trigger asthma in children. There's kind of
Yeah, and again, our earlier presentation showed that our ozone problem is now very focused on these really high, bad ozone days. And the Healthy Air Act did a great job. It's helped us resolve the fine particulate problem in Maryland. We're attaining fine particulate. We've made huge progress reducing ozone, but we're now very focused on what happens on the worst ozone days, which unfortunately line up with the days when you need energy the most.
It's not quite instantaneous. It takes some time for ozone to form, and it is a very well-mixed soup. It is not, this is a regional problem. So doing something in Maryland, taking out one of these units, let's just call it this hypothetical unit 3, and let's say you remove that from the system, may mean that some much higher emitting unit just over the line in Pennsylvania flips on instead. The generation is not going to stop just because you take out this unit. The demand side, people for air conditioning and lights.
Dr. Salowich, what do you got?
Well, I just This is provocative. Thank you. My concern is this: these words I used before, wiggle room, in here that, you know, if the other plants have come in way below the 0.09, which is credit to the investment there, that this is going to allow us to basically move forward with doing nothing more to the plants that have the old technology, because again, you'll only be running them for a few days during the summer, so you'll roll in, you'll average it with the rest of the month where the cleaner plants are running. And my concern with that is just the science that my group has done at University of Maryland has shown there is a quantitatively meaningful relationship between the emission of NOx and temperature. So more NOx is emitted to the atmosphere in Maryland on hot, on those dog days of summer because of these units. So they talk about something called the climate penalty factor, which is the correlation of surface ozone with temperature. That's meteorologically driven, but it's also plant emission driven. And the science really just says that we have to go after the emissions on those dog days of summer, and we can't wiggle out of it.
We appreciate the need to reduce NOx. Right now, our system 30-day average is a 0.15. So how would we get to a 0.09 without reduction? So what would happen is the units that don't have controls would run less frequently, but they'd be there for the hours and the days that they're really needed by the system. So they would curtail operations. They'd be running less frequently. But you know, your wiggle room is—I wouldn't characterize it as wiggle room, because this is a 0.09 would create meaningful reductions.
Good. Thanks, Mr. Stone. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
And next up, we have Michael Powell, please.
Good evening. You're going to hear something a little bit different. You're going to hear Scarenflub and Raven Power are both on the same page, and both support the language that the Department of the Environment has had in front of you. There's not too many times when I stood before this group, and I have the environmental group and an energy company, both on the same page. I can tell you that during this stakeholder, there was an awful lot of arm wrestling going on. The Sierra guys are a lot younger and stronger than I am, and you can tell. But at the end of the day, what Department of the Environment has proposed to you today is something which Sierra Club, as you'll hear in a minute, has endorsed, and Raven Power has endorsed. What does it do? It does exactly what Department of the Environment said the goal here was. During phase one, everyone is going to be required to run the plant exactly in the best manner that can be achieved. And some very aggressive numbers here for phase one, okay? When I was here last time, I was telling you that these numbers would have forced the closure of a plant. So the department has looked at the data and said, yeah, with more data, and in particular, Raven did a summer study where they ran the plants exactly the way the Department of the Environment wanted, collected the data. We were able to provide that to the department since the last meeting. So we're confident now that during phase one, this forces the plants to run it the best way they possibly can. Now, during phase two, okay, one of the things the department has done is there's been a trade-off here. The original phase two the department proposed had flexibility in it. NRG complains about that flexibility went away. When they took the flexibility to do it different ways, it was necessary to extend the deadline. I'm being told I'm not talking loud enough. Let me try it. There was a lot of shouting in the stakeholder group, too. No, not really. What we have is we had to add a couple more years to it once you take the flexibility away. And I mention these things because there were questions about a couple of things in the regulations. And I wanted to make sure you understood those were not tweaks. Those are essential to the compromise. For example, there was a question about what if one unit was sold to someone different than everyone else. And I'm saying this may not be a matter of somebody just decided to do it. There are mergers going on. FERC or Tort Justice may say you've got to sell a unit. And the problem is if somebody buys a single facility in Maryland, they no longer have a system. So you can't do a system average. and you don't want to force something to be sold during phase one and have a reliability crisis just because you didn't deal with that situation. Because it was written carefully to say somebody cannot control more than one facility, there really is not an opportunity to game that. If you took that out, frankly, the compromise falls apart. And at that point, Raven certainly would not be part of any understanding, and we're back to the issue we were last time of do we have to have litigation. The 2018 to 2020, as I explained, there's a trade-off there. The NRG would like you to have the flexibility back in there. We're okay if you take the flexibility out. I know Sierra Club's big issue is they objected strongly to that flexibility. The compromise, the quid pro quo, if you will, in sort of where does MDE go with this, which MDE proposed, where, okay, we'll take the flexibility out, but we'll give a couple more years to get there. The including but not limited to language, the bottom line is no energy company wants to be in a violation. And it is absolutely clear from the data that during startup, shutdown, and low load, you cannot meet the numbers. So the choice was for the department to loosen the numbers or to provide that those are special circumstances to be dealt with in the plan. And I think the compromise the Department of Environment proposed of keeping very stiff numbers but providing some exception for those makes sense. So in summary, Raven Power is trying to do the right thing here. We're here supporting these regulations. We thank the Department of the Environment for their leadership on this. And we thank the Sierra Club for being able to sit down with us and work out something that we could all live with. If there are any questions, I'd be more than happy to provide them to answer.
Council members, thoughts, questions?
What would that, practically speaking, what would that alternative compliance flexibility, what might you have done?
What we might have done, what NRG was proposing, you would have over-controlled in some days and then during the 30-day average, you'd over-controlled in some days and then been able to exceed it on other days. I mean, understand, that flexibility is something we would have liked option three, don't get me wrong. We're prepared to live with option two and we support, option two and option three were phrases from the stakeholder process. We support what the Department of the Environment has on the table. If this group voted for the NRG proposal, we're not going to challenge it. But we and the Sierra Club have both said the one before you is something we can live with and we can support. Have both said...
Is that enough for you?
Well, but what I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the flexibility would have allowed exactly the kind of emissions on high days that Dr. Salovich was concerned about.
It is true that if you had that flexibility and you had a 30-day average, you could have over-controlled on some days and then emitted more on other days. And I think that was why Sierra Club wanted that proposal eliminated. But that is what triggered the need then to make it 2020 instead of 2018.
Any follow-up, Mr. Schellen?
No.
I'll throw out the question before. So let me ask in a general way. Why is the two-year extension so important to Raven Power?
Because what you're really looking at is a very high chance of these units closing. Okay. Now there's no flexibility. You either got to put on SCR, you got to put on gas, or you have to close. For many of these units, gas is not basically an option, either because there is no gas pipeline or because during the winter months there is no gas supply on a firm basis available. SCR simply today do not make economic sense. Now, by extending the deadline to 2020, there's a chance that the economics will change. We'll have to decide at that point. But if you force an earlier decision on that, you are forcing exactly the kind of reliability crisis that we described earlier. 2020 sounds like it's a ways away, but when you think about what's required to get a permit, for example, for a new gas plant, or God forbid, a new gas line or a new transmission line, to get those things permitted and built by 2020 is a huge order. Get it by 2018, you're saying, no, we're going to gamble, And if we have another call of Vartex or something like that, we're going to just take our chances. So what we think the department has done, to its credit, is say we're going to make phase two standards tougher. We're going to give you two more years.
Any other questions or comments? Thanks, Mr. Fowler. Next up, I have Steve Arabia.
Mr. Chairman, I have nothing further to add. However, my colleague, who's more expert than I, was hearing some things that we'd like to respond to.
I'm sorry. So I had two people. We're having trouble. Could you stand up and speak very loudly?
I have nothing additional to add to our presentation. However, we were hearing some things that Mr. Powell was saying that we would like to respond to, and I'd like to defer to my colleague, Walter Stone, to do that.
Yeah, well, let's hold off on that, and okay. Let's go through the list. And then, who was asking the question about?
I was asking about the cost of getting a microphone.
I think we'll just have to get the speakers to speak up. I'm so sorry. We just don't have the facilities for that. This isn't our usual crowd. We're glad to have so many people interested. Next up, we have David Smedic.
Good morning, all. I spoke last time, and thank you again for the opportunity to come back.
The pressure's on to speak up, though.
Oh, fair enough. All right. I'll approach everyone. Again, my name is David Smedic. I'm providing these comments on behalf of the Sierra Club. As numerous stakeholders have emphasized at the previous council meeting back in September, Marylanders are subject to the worst air quality in the East and suffer from some of the highest rates of asthma. Indeed, you heard from multiple community members, many who are still around here today, who face personal challenges with respiratory issues exacerbated by our poor air quality. Today, there are dozens more Marylanders here, and the Department of State have heard from almost 3,000 individuals on this issue, and we've collected almost 700 comments in the last month alone since we came here last. Marylanders are aware of the problem, and we're looking for a solution. In-state coal plants are a major contributor to the state's failing air quality for two important reasons. First, because of flexibility in existing regulations, which we've discussed, they've only set annual and ozone season limits, and many of Maryland's coal units have not consistently operated their existing emission controls. Second, half of the state's coal units still lack the state-of-the-art SCR emission control technology, and as a result, most poorly controlled units emit at rates up to 10 times those of the best controlled units in the state. We're a significant outlier in eastern states in prevalence of SCR controls, ranking 16th out of 18 East Coast states with coal plants trailing. We're trailing states like Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Alabama with the prevalence of this control technology. The draft regulations before you represent a critical opportunity for Maryland to bring itself in line with other eastern states that have already modernized and put these controls on their fleets. Like the prior draft, the regulations require SCR level control at all of the coal units. At the same time, the current draft reflects significant compromises and concessions to the plant owners for the regulations that were previously presented. As we discussed, the daily limits for several units were increased to address technical concerns that the plant owners provided. The unit-specific emission rate for phase two got bumped from 0.07 to 0.09 pound per MMBTU. And most significantly, the compliance deadline was pushed back from 2018 to 2020, now providing the plant owners 6 years to bring the units into compliance. The current draft is a process of significant negotiation and compromise. We want you to hear that from the Sierra Club that was in the room for these. And the past 4 weeks ultimately garnered the support of the department, Raven Power, and the Sierra Club. It's not without reservation that we endorsed the regulations, but we believe they represent a workable compromise addressing all technical concerns raised by the plant owners while ensuring significant health protections for Marylanders, albeit on a delayed timeline. We would certainly prefer to see a regulation that required emission reductions in a more accelerated time frame, given the severity of the smog problem. However, in the spirit of compromise and the negotiating process and the stakeholder meetings, the Sierra Club endorses the compromise drafts and urges the council to do the same. I want to close, actually, with a comment that we just recently collected from a Baltimore resident. I think it's really important to recognize the group that's here today. And this is from a Baltimore resident. Every move MDE makes to help clean up our air here in Baltimore will really improve the quality of our lives. 3-year-old twins in my family hack and cough while playing in Latrobe Park in South Baltimore, but not when they are running a plane out to county. I know it is the air, for I too can feel the difference, even though I am not swinging on the swings and sliding down the slides. Good health is a privilege we are born with. Let's continue to push vehemently to create cleaner air for us all here in our beautiful state so that we can continue to enjoy the privilege of good health. Thank you all.
Just one second. Any questions or comments from the council?
Thank you.
Thanks for speaking today. Next up, I have Josh Berman.
Hi, guys. Josh Berman with the Sierra Club. This can be quick. I just wanted to respond, be in a position to respond to some of the things that you guys are hearing today. You know, it's interesting. I'm not going to say anything I was planning to say. I mean, it was interesting to listen to NRG's presentation today. I think it's important to... I think you guys have already hit on all of the key points. You know, the NRG's ultimate negotiating position that they got to a couple days ago was, as if they were going to go with the 24-hour, they were looking at fleet-wide 0.1, which translates to 30 tons a day of NOx. And I just wanted to put that in context for folks, because this is why we were unable to reach a compromise that included all of the parties. If you look at NRG's historic emissions over the last 7 ozone seasons, which is approximately 1,000 days, the fleet-wide total exceeded 35 tons on only 9 days, so less than 1% of the time, and the fleet-wide total exceeded 33 tons on 29 days, so less than 3% of the time. So basically, the position that NRG ultimately offered to the environmental community and to Raven and to the department was, we're willing to take a 10 to 15% reduction off of historic emissions on 1 to 3% of days 6 years in the future. And ultimately, that to us is not a negotiating position. We're not thrilled with negotiating on 2018 to 2020, which for all the reasons that folks on the council have already identified, we think 2018 is fully appropriate. I would also note that if you actually play out the numbers from the draft regulation that was before you a month ago, this regulation in every regard is weaker. The only thing that it does, and which we believe ultimately is important based on the stakeholder meetings where it became clear that it was being, I would say, willfully misinterpreted, is that this regulation provides greater clarity. It ensures that we are actually going to get cleanup at the units that don't have state-of-the-art controls. But this regulation is a huge compromise, and we do support it. You know, and we're thrilled that, you know, one of the plant owners recognized the significant compromise here and is willing to get on board. But ultimately, the reason that we did not reach a position that NRG was willing to agree to is that they were putting 10 to 15% reduction on 1 to 3% of ozone days 6 years in the future on the table, and that was their bottom line. And that is not, we believe, a negotiating position. So here we are. We think you guys should pass this regulation. We're not thrilled about some of the aspects of it, but, you know, I think, you know, this is what we got, and I think it really is going to make a huge difference for cleaning up Maryland's air, and that is really what this is all about. So thanks.
Thank you. Please stay. Questions or comments? Thank you so much. Next up, I have Larry Mullen.
Hi, good morning.
Remember loud for me, Ted.
Nice and loud, okay. I live in Baltimore City, and I live in Curtis Bay, Brooklyn area. And I thought I'd mention two quick things, one local and then one very broad. In Curtis Bay, Brooklyn, it's a very polluted area. And I just would like to put out a dream. It's kind of unadult-like of me. But just to have an area of sort of non-industry, rezoned area, where we remove all emitters, you know, smokestack industries, and especially some of the small industries that I think are real culprits. And I'd love to have sort of an inner harbor thing, a little beach, and that'd be nice. I think that will happen over the next 50 years, but looking at our ages, you know, in 12 years I'll be 70, and looking at our ages, a lot of us may not be around for it, but wouldn't it be nice if we were? The other thing I'd like to mention, again, this is way out, maybe in the future, but for the industries that are now using coal, I just see so much profit and benefit if, in the future, as time goes on, if we could switch to solar, and not only the panels, but there's got to be a way with all this STEM education, science, math, engineering, to have boilers. Have you ever had a magnifying glass on your hand and you get burned? There's so much heat with that. And I think that, you know, maybe some of the elementary school students of today are going to probably get to that. You know, they don't have to worry about cursive writing, so they can focus on, you know, solar power. But I see this for an industry benefit. So there's so much benefit for industry on this, and I think industry will help us. But in the meantime, my dream is for Curtis Bay, that small southeastern area of Baltimore City, to become more green and just reduce the industry. You know, we're past the World War II era of, you know, emitters and rendering and all that other stuff. So I thought I'd throw that out, and hopefully people will take it up, and some of these ideas may go viral. So I hope you have your smartphones out. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Wait, please, one second. Any questions or comments?
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
All in the future. Thank you. All right.
Next up, I have Leah Kelly from the speak, please.
Sorry.
Right up here, please. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Leah Kelly, and I'm here with the Environmental Integrity Project. We're an organization that advocates throughout the country for the better enforcement of environmental laws and protection of public health. We also have a program focused solely on pollution sources that affect Baltimore specifically. I'm going to make my comments very brief. As part of our Baltimore program, I've met many community members and health workers that work in Baltimore and have discussed with us the magnitude of the local problems with asthma. In one Baltimore high school in which we work, a question was asked all to individual classes about how many students in the classes had asthma. In most of the classes, it was a significant number. In one class, every single hand went up. This was actually the high school in Curtis Bay. We also know that Baltimore is failing to meet federal standards for ozone, which can worsen the symptoms of asthma and other respiratory conditions. For this reason, like our partner groups today, we support a strong rule that will decrease the amount of nitrogen oxides in the air and decrease ozone levels in Baltimore. We are very concerned about the recent revision that extends the time to install SCR from 2018 to 2020. But other than that, we think that this is a strong step in the right direction for Maryland, and we ask that the council support the rule.
Thank you so much. Please wait just a second. Any questions or comments from the council? Thank you very much. And our final speaker signed up is Josh Tolkien. We can get you up to the front, please.
I actually have no additional comments.
So Mr. Tolkien says he has no additional comments. So council, we've had a request to have some response from the NRG person to an earlier speaker. Is that all right with everyone? Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Stone.
Thank you very much. Just a couple things. Mr. Smedic said something that's just not right, where he said that there are only annual and ozone season limits on the plants. We actually do have 30-day limits, 0.15 for the system, 0.1 for Morgantown. Raven is our competitor. No surprise there, and our assets, frankly, are different. So their business model is different than ours. We invested much more in scrubbers than the predecessor company, the company that owned the Raven assets before. So one of the reasons that this is an acceptable provision for them is it dovetails with their business model. Nothing wrong there. It just works for them. We're not similarly situated, I guess, the takeaway. We heard a lot of some numbers from Mr. Berman about the number of tons. I think that mischaracterizes what the reductions would be. The reductions would, for us to hit a number that's nearly 40% less than what our system averages today, would require reductions all the time, not just on a few days. Now, that's the only way the math works. It would occur throughout the season. I also recall hearing some time ago that the power plants are they're not the biggest problem for ozone. I think it's a roughly 10% of the problem is attributable to the issues attributable to power plants. So it's largely a mobile source problem today. So that's something to keep in mind. And the last thing I have is just, I encourage you to Google Ivanpah. It's one of our, you described our latest concentrated solar facility, which we co-own with Google. So it is out there, costs $2 billion. For 340 megawatts and in California. So it's a neat facility. I encourage you to look at it. So we are doing things to reduce the pollution that comes from the power plant, the emissions that come from power plants. but it takes time and lots of money. So.
Thank you. Any questions?
I just want to understand the bottom line. You're arguing against this rule because it doesn't have the flexibility that you want?
Correct. We believe that system averaging gets you most of what we need, most of what is necessary.
System averaging that would still allow the kind of emissions that Dr. Salovich was concerned about, and also emerging technologies, unspecified emerging technologies that would substitute for catalytic rate reduction.
That's right. I mean, someone may invent it 2 years from now. We just don't know. So long as the numbers are achieved, I would believe that the regulators would be indifferent. The environment certainly would be indifferent if the reductions take place by some gizmo that Google invented yesterday.
Dutch Salad?
So just for a point of record, and the document that we're handed out, there's a list of affected units: Brandon Shores, C.P. Crane, Chalk Point. So my question is, if you can just review which of these are operated by your company and which are operated
sure.
by Raven, that would.
So I know this off the top of my head. We own the Chalk Point Unit 2 and 1. Chalk 2 does not have an SCR, and we own the 3 Dickerson units. We also own the Morgantown plant. The balance is owned by Raven.
Okay, it was Chalk Point, Dickerson.
Chalk and Dickerson and Morgantown. But Morgantown's probably, yep, those are our plants.
Okay, great. And so obviously if all the units would be owned by the same company, so it's roughly a 50-50 split.
There's an AES unit that may not be on the chart. Warrior Run, it's not on the chart. It has a separate limit of a 0.1, which interestingly is higher than what we're arguing for as a system average.
But they've already added state-of-the-art technologies.
Okay, so that's good. Very useful information for the record. So if this council does decide to endorse it the way it's been presented here, and then, of course, there's a whole lot of other things that happen afterwards, but if this were to pass in this way, what do you think the implications for Chalk Point, Dickerson, and Morgantown will be?
Well, Morgantown units are scrubbed and have SCRs, so that's problem solved there. One of the two Chalk units, all of our coal plants are scrubbed. Okay, so 4 of them are missing, do not have SCRs. Missing is the wrong word, do not yet have SCRs. It makes them, under today's economic environment, they just don't support that kind of investment.
Right.
It's conceivable that would change in the next couple of years, but today they're just not supporting.
And we talked about this last time. I mean, there had been the closure. I'm sorry, I don't know the exact words, but I had heard rumors that Dickerson was going to close before this ever came before us.
So we filed what's called a deactivation notice in anticipation. Well, because MDE was working on NOx regulations, we informed the ISO that we intended to deactivate it. We postponed that or rolled over another year when there was a delay on the NOx regulations.
So if this goes through, do you foresee SCRs going into Dickerson, or?
The economics simply don't support that today. Yes.
Can you, while you're on economics, you know, in the backup material, it appears that Wagner and 2 and Chalk Point 2 have analogous economic impacts in terms of the cost per ton for removal of NOx. But yet, when you compare the others, you know, your analysis or whoever performed this analysis is considerably higher in an annual operating cost per ton removed for your Dickerson's plants versus the Crane plants.
Okay. And there's a great explanation on that, which is it is less expensive to build one big box for a 300 megawatt unit than to build three little boxes, which is why when we put on these controls, we put them on the 2 big Morgantown units and 1 of the Chalk units, Dickerson units being the smallest.
Yes.
Just a question, clarification. Based on the highlighted entries in your slide, the proposed changes from NRG are to not to fix the SCR requirement, but just to require the performance requirement to prevail.
Right.
To eliminate the requirement for mandatory switching to natural gas from coal, but to leave it as a fuel switching requirement from coal. And finally, the system-wide rolling average.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Back to the system-wide rolling average. You made a comment at the end of your first presentation with the slides about how what you were showing was a straw man, essentially, not representative of your fleet. Then you made a comment near the end about how your fleet would necessarily operate in a manner that would be closer to the state's target for limiting short-term emissions. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Right now, our ozone season system average is a 0.15, and what is contemplated by this is a 0.09. So let's take 0.06 off the 0.15. So how would we achieve such a number on a 30-day rolling basis? We would have to run the relatively higher NOx units less frequently. So they would be there on the days that they're absolutely necessary, but generally they would run much less than they run today.
And on the days that they're absolutely necessary, they would still operate without controls.
Right? Well, they have controls today. They just don't have SCRs. Right. They have dry low NOx burners. They've got SNCRs, over-fired air. So we've come a long way in NOx reduction from where the unit started 10, 15 years ago.
But touching on Dr. Salowich's point about the time sensitivity of NOx and ozone precursor emissions and high ozone days, how can you reconcile that system-wide averaging suggestion with the state's objective?
So if it's not economic to put on the controls, then the unit's not there, which means some other unit will have to pick up that slack because the demand doesn't disappear because we shut down a unit or can't operate a unit. So some other unit in the system is going to pick that up, and it may indeed be higher than the unit that's shut down.
Of course, the department only has control of the units in this state.
Right, but this is one of the unintended consequences. And frankly, it might be a unit in the state. It's not a coal unit.
It could be
emergency demand response, which is hospitals flipping on their diesel generators with very high NOx rates.
Well, I know the state's concerned about those kinds of issues. So yeah, I'm sure they've looked hard at it. It still seems as though that the system-wide averaging is really not workable at the proposed level for the state in order to meet their objectives, particularly in light of the anticipated new ozone standard.
So maybe one way to think about it is how these system averages have worked in the past. Indeed, when we instituted an annual, not 30-day, an annual cap for ozone season caps, we saw very large reductions. Enormous reductions. And the air quality in Maryland, there's some graphs that are upstairs outside of Tad's office that show what happened when the Healthy Air Act was passed. And it did address those very hot days. There was big improvement.
Dr. Salowich,
yes. I want to somewhat meet you in the middle if I can, because
sure.
I really do appreciate you being up here and engaging in the conversation. By saying meet you in the middle, you know, there is merit to the 30-day rolling average in the sense that our lungs are affected by everything we breathe every day, period, end of story. And so if we can lower that, that's good for public health, period, end of story. But what EPA does, for better or worse, I actually happen to think for worse, but it is what it is. They limit they regulate the extreme events. That's how they do it, the extreme events.
Sure.
And those extreme events, those exceedance days that we're going after, do tend to occur on the dog days of summer. They just do. In fact, you could throw away all your fancy air quality forecast models if you have a good idea what temperature is going to be in the meteorological patterns, you can just sort of by eyeball predict when we're going to have bad air quality days. And so it's those emissions on those days that those are the acute bad days, and that's what EPA decides to regulate. And my concern is that we're still going to have exceedances if we have in here the system-wide 30-day rolling average. Even though it does help the larger picture, it still leaves us in trouble with EPA, and those are, you know, the reason that those are the days we predict bad ozone is the air is trapped here.
Sure.
You know, the Bermuda high sets in, and the air is just stagnated here.
Right. So, and it's, when you say here, it's not Maryland, it's the region.
Yeah, the Mid-Atlantic.
It's one big soup.
The Mid-Atlantic.
That's right.
So it's a tough situation, but we have to deal with EPA as well.
Well, one thing to think about is that for this ozone standard that's before us today, the data are showing, at least in Baltimore, are now clean. We have 3 years of clean data. So one way to address this may be to simply wait until the next ozone standard comes out.
I want to respond to clean data. And maybe some of the health people can speak to this as well. The EPA sets numbers based on a long and lengthy negotiation process with the regulated industry, and the health effects don't magically go away at the level that is selected. So clean means it meets some level, I don't want to say arbitrary, but it's a negotiated level.
I have a few comments.
Greg, love to hear them.
Number one, I agree with the fact that even when you have one unit going up and all the others have very low NOx, it's still enough NOx to affect several people and send them to the hospital. We've been talking here about economics. We've been talking about decreasing number or putting technology, but we never heard about what's going to how it's going to affect the people. So, again, the average over a month does not mean anything, okay? Because it takes only one day or even half a day for high NOx in the air to affect people. Number two, the fact to go to 2020. Again, it's 5-6 years from now. I mean, technology is moving so fast. Suddenly it takes so long to do something. I mean, that's to me, I don't understand that. Especially when we hear that the negotiation or the dialogue has been going on for 2 years. 2 years, and now we have 3 more years ahead. You should have been prepared to do something. So, but last and not least, everybody who get up here are saying, we really agree, NOx is very bad, we need a clean air act, clean air, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, if we are all concerned citizens and even corporate, okay, why do we need so much regulation? Why do we need so much discussion about regulating how we make our air clean? We cannot self-control. So now, I mean, that's the least thing we could do. So we're going through all this negotiation and spending so much time about a little thing here and there, so to prolong the time and whatever. It doesn't mean sense. I mean, when you come up, anybody who comes up and say, I'm concerned about the NOx, and then I'm arguing for years and months and years on about how to regulate because I need somebody to come and the police telling me what to do. I mean, that doesn't make sense.
Would you like me to address that?
Sure.
Can. Well, first of all, NOx emissions today don't mean high ozone levels today. It's not instantaneous.
Sorry, sir. I have to stop you. Ozone is a problem, but NOx is another problem, too. NOx can affect the health of a people. Of course, ozone is generated by NOx with heat and VOC, but NOx itself is harmful, too.
Okay. And what we're talking about today is achieving the regulation that's driving this is ozone. But on the issue of you raised some interesting policy issues, which is one of the things that political leaders have to do is balance cost, reliability, and cleanliness. One can make, you know, in theory, one could very quickly, not quickly, in a generation, switch to renewables, but it comes at a very high cost and a degradation of reliability. And when the power goes out, people die. Traffic lights go out. People who use CPAP machines can't use them that night. So the bad things happen, right? So that's the balance of it. It's that triangle between reliability, cost, and how clean the air is, and water. On the issue of timing, we actually require permission from various regulators before we change something in the power plant. So we can't just slap an SCR and change the makeup of our wastewater stream on our own. So it requires going through various hurdles, both at the state level, county level.
I do understand that, and I do respect, because you really, I mean, it has to be compromised. But it seems like it's becoming more and more big deal and bigger issues than it has to be. I know it has to be compromised.
Sure.
And I think the department have done a tremendous job in trying to meet, you know, everybody's concern, everybody's well-being. But, you know, it's becoming too much. I don't know. I mean,
And there's been a tremendous effort to install air quality. We just in this state have spent $1.7 billion just in Maryland
on
improving air quality. So, and so things are heading in the right direction, and it's the balancing.
Well, I do need to correct one thing. Our ozone problem is very complicated. There's a large regional piece that builds up over the course of many days. That is very true. So when I'm arguing with Indiana, I am arguing about the high ozone that they help create across a broad region. But the NOx emissions on a day do matter. We can see that there's a local piece that you can see it every day. You can see the regional load drop down. We already start off with maybe 50, 60, 70 ppb ozone as the regional pollution sort of drops from aloft. And then our local emissions add another 10, 20, 30 ppb ozone. So the NOx emissions on any given day do matter quite a bit. Now, there are some mobile sources that have large NOx emissions each day. But on those specific days when the power plants have all the smaller units running because high electricity demand is kicked in, they are very important. Matter of fact, like I said in our plan, this will be the largest ozone-reducing piece other than the federal CAR law and the upwind power plant piece in our plan. This is a fairly large ozone-reducing program in our plan.
Just procedurally, I just want to move along if we want to move along. If you need more time for questions, if we can do a lot of back and forth. We still actually have a little bit of gap in our agenda. The thoughts of the council, are we done with public comment? Do we need to have more interaction with public comment? I purposely have not tried to move towards equal time for people that were in favor, people that were opposed, and people that were in the middle. I tried to follow the procedure of people. Well, this is a continuation of our last meeting where everyone in the room spoke, and this was a follow-up based on the negotiations and the event that happened. So I just want to get the council's sense of where we should go. Please be very vocal. Mr. Stone, you can sit.
Thank you very much.
We'll call you back.
I'm done with the public. I'd like us to discuss.
Great. So, in case people didn't hear, Mr. Schoen suggested that the council is ready to have a discussion among itself, and I think we're done, at least for now, with any further public input. So, Mr. Schoen, I turn it to you. What would you like? How would you
like
to
be discussed? I'll speak in favor of a motion that hasn't yet been made. Maybe shouldn't. I don't know. To go back to the 2018 date, and here are some of the reasoning behind it. And people have talked about the possibility that plants may have to shut down. I don't know if there's a possibility for expedited retrofit. But there's a lot going on outside this room related to the marketplace. There's on the demand side. I happen to work in the green buildings area. where we have technologies for lighting, for instance, LED lighting, that are far more efficient than what we had readily available just a few years ago. There's a new memorandum of understanding between the U.S. Green Building Council, ASHRAE, the Illumination Society, and the International Code Council to sort of bring together all of these green building codes that will increase efficiency and decrease demand, therefore. There is, on the production side, I'm not an expert on the production side, but I know there are other ways to produce electricity. There's solar, wind, there's gas, of course, and there's nuclear. I don't know if the world is going to come to an end if certain coal plants do have to cease operations. There are also peak load management systems. I personally, at my home, participate in the one where BGE shuts off my air conditioner on the peak days. There are incentives that the power distributors can put into place, both on the residential and on the industrial and on the commercial building side, to have demand load management. Another side of the marketplace, you know, we've talked a little bit about public notices to the SEC and so on. There's no surprise in the investment community that plants may either have to close or may have to have expensive retrofits. I'm not an expert on what it takes to install SCR, but I do know on the commercial building construction side, when there's an incentive and a market incentive, and when there's a need, construction can be accelerated. It sometimes costs more, and marketplaces adapt. I guess the other thing I want to touch on is that there was some intimation about possible litigation. Well, litigation is always possible. I think what's necessary for us and the department to do is to be reasonable, listen to all of the stakeholders, and make what we believe is the right decision. So
that's may I just follow up with a question to you? So very well said, and thanks for taking the lead on how we move forward. But it seems to me we weren't involved for the last month with those long meetings and all the things that you said were considered in that group, and you had MDE, Sierra Club, Raven, and NRG in a room, and they came to a conclusion, and it's more or less been after analysis. And sometimes we bring them back for meetings like we did this time. We usually defer to those longer, more detailed processes. So my question to you is, why do you suggest moving off of a major aspect of that if it hasn't been sufficiently explained, or you reject their conclusion, is, I guess, the bottom line question.
And I guess that's why I had speaking in favor of a motion that hasn't been made. Okay, I purposely didn't make the motion because I know there has been a background process in the negotiation, and I struggle with it. But I do believe that the 2018 is the marketplace can achieve the 2018. But I understand it might. And I did hear the environmental community say, yeah, we sort of agree with this compromise, but we really think that the 2018 is possible and we'd like to see it.
The reaction?
Well, I'm just going to take a different tack.
Go right ahead.
To Larry's point and also to the comments that NRG made about the need for system-wide averaging, and to your point about what the council doesn't know about what the department's negotiations have involved, I think I'm in a better place about the 2020 compromise if the department has vetted that thoroughly, but I'd still like to understand a little better how the department views the issues that Mr. Stone raised about the sort of natural displacement of capacity that results as a result of these types of regulations and economic forces and the presence of other units within the power pool that are not governed by this regulation, and the issue that Mr. Stone raised about people running their their smaller stationary sources.
So are you requesting that we go back to public input?
Nope. I'm asking to understand the department's thinking about that issue.
Oh, good. Okay. That's good.
Sure. There's a couple issues in your question. So let's start off with the first one, which is the system-wide approach. As you know, we proposed that on September 8th. It had a very aggressive endpoint. To have a plan that allowed for a system-wide alternative, it had a tough test. And I think you guys have sort of honed in on the big issue, which is the difference between a 30-day rolling average and the difference between a 24-hour block average. So I think that if we could have honed in on a solution that was something like 0.08 pound per million BTU, 24-hour block average, we may have had that fourth flexible option in there, because that's the kind of number that would have guaranteed that the change on those peak days does happen. So that's one piece. We are working on the issue of displacing energy production to upwind states, and it does happen, but we are working very hard to actually level the playing field. So many of the arguments that we're making in this regulatory process, like just run your controls really well every day, are arguments we're making in our process working with upwind states. The piece that hasn't come up today is that a ton of reductions in Maryland is actually more beneficial than a ton of reductions in Pennsylvania, and clearly more beneficial than a ton of reductions in Indiana. So the science says that, the modeling says that, and so, and again, there's no perfect answer. If I had a silver bullet for the ozone problem, if it was simply regulating one source in one category, it's not. Our plan involves reductions from mobile sources, reductions from upwind power plants, reductions from local power plants, so it all fits together. And what we do have this concern, like I said, there's no silver bullet. There are many things we worry about. We have worried for the past few years about the way the energy system now provides incentives for folks with smaller diesel generators to run those diesel generators on the days when we've got some data. There's some issues we need to look at, but we're just not seeing that as being a huge, significant issue right now. We're continuing to look at it. We're data poor on that issue, so we are looking at it, but we don't have a regulation in the works. It's an analysis piece. We're doing the same thing. Our OTC counterparts are doing the same thing. And it does appear that the changes in the system for calling on folks to do extra effort on the high demand days run by the ISOs, the independent service operators, the folks that run the grid system, have now sort of set up a priority system where people are asked to do things like reduce their energy consumption by turning off lights instead of you moving to diesel generators. So it is an issue. It pales in comparison to the benefit we would get from this regulation.
So to Mr. Stone's comment about unintended consequences, the department is satisfied that it's a good trade-off.
I will tell you that's one of the reasons why Governor O'Malley was one of eight governors to sign a 176A petition, because in essence that says we need to level the playing field between what we're trying to do in Maryland and what happens in states upwind of us, because it is a big issue. We run a fairly sophisticated research program, and there's clearly a huge regional part to our ozone problem. There's also a local part.
Thank you.
Dr. Sowers.
I have two things. One is my first point is to ask Tad to follow up on Larry's comment about the 2018 versus 2020 and what the position of the group you represent in the stakeholder meeting was on that, with a nuance there. Does this get us in trouble with EPA with the SIP, or are we going to be okay? That's my first point. And then the second one has to do with what happens if a unit's owned by just a single entity. We would come back to that after you answer the first.
Sure. So so we are comfortable, MDE is comfortable with the 2020, and it is a compromise. I mean, our original rule said 2018, and that is to a certain extent driven by
deadlines in the Clean Air Act, but we have a new standard coming. So the reality is that we didn't get into a lot of this detail, but we could. To install a selective catalytic reduction system, let me see if I can, when you walked in this building, did you take a look at the size of this building? That is what the SCR technology looks like. It's about as big as this building. And I remember when the SCR and the scrubbers were being installed at Brandon Shores, thousands, it takes a good 2 or 3 years to install an SCR. It's like building a little, it's like a little city. So part of our thinking is that 2018 requires decisions right now. This gives folks a couple more years to make those decisions, but it's going to be a concrete decision. It's going to be add the SCR, convert to natural gas, or retire the unit. So we're comfortable with the 2020 piece of this, even though if there was a way to make it 2018, we would. I think it's a delicate piece of the compromise, so we're comfortable with it. So.
Okay, thanks, Ted. And my other question is, looking at the new words on the document we were sent, B3 says an affected EGU is not subject to B1 if the unit is located at an electrical generating facility that is the only facility in Maryland owned, operated, or controlled by the owner. B1 is the rolling average, is the system-wide average. So what are they controlled by?
There's two things. One is that they are still controlled by the minimize emissions by optimizing the technology on those units. That is a constraint. And then under the Healthy Air Act, and if you look at the rule, the Healthy Air Act limits are in this rule. They still remain in place. The Healthy Air Act establishes caps for each individual unit and then gives a company the flexibility to, once again, average amongst its units to meet a cumulative cap. And so what we've done is we said, well, what if a unit is sold? You have the minimize the reductions piece of this in place, and then you have the Healthy Air Act cap. So at least the situation we've looked at, it appears that actually the Healthy Air cap, when not part of a system, would significantly constrain emissions from an individual plant. So we have those two constraints, and we're comfortable with that. That's why we included the language.
Okay, but for B3 here, I wonder if it would be clearer, more transparent to add a few more words saying what they are subject by. Because the way it's written, it's what they're not subject to.
Okay.
And just for clarity, if this ever comes up.
Yeah, well, now we have that language. Again, regulations are inherently difficult to read because if you look at can somebody point me to the language that says comply with the Healthy Air Act caps?
03B.
Yeah. So if you look under over under 03B. It says the owner or operator of an affected electricity unit subject to the provisions of this regulation shall continue to meet the ozone season NOx reduction requirements under COMAR 26-11-27. Yeah. So it already says that you have to continue to comply with that, which is for the ozone season, it's an ozone season cap. So you have the daily constraint, and you have an ozone season constraint that ensures that you won't have increases in emissions. Now, lower, you also see the under annual NOx reduction requirements, you see that, again, the annual cap in the Healthy Air Act is maintained. So we already sort of have that language in there that creates those constraints, and we at MDE are comfortable with that.
Okay.
Good question. Just before we go to the next, someone told me they were leaving at 10:30. Yes. So please keep that in mind. We still have a few minutes before that, but just if you want to say anything?
No.
Please say something.
Okay. I represent two constituencies, the seniors, because I am one, and I'm a pediatrician. So this is, as you all may, vitally important because we talk about asthma. That's the common disease that people talk about. This is far more comprehensive than asthma. It's the development of lungs. Children's lungs don't grow well in a polluted environment. And that's been well documented over the years. So my position is moving forward as aggressively as we possibly can. And I bring no particular thoughts on how we go through this maze of that has been so well pointed out for us by Gordon, of Mr. Stone, excuse me, Mr. Gordon, sorry about that. by Mr. Stone. My background in the medical part of this, it does not help me understand the best way forward.
Called on you is because you're so valuable to this group, and your value goes the long distance professional, and I don't want you to have to speed and drive fast.
Oh no,
and risk.
I don't have a deadline. I want to leave about 10:30. So
okay, have to leave. I want to make sure you spoke. Any other thoughts, questions, comments?
Oh, John, I wanted to let the council know that on the first page of many of the drafts that have gone out, there was elimination of rates that exist already in 26.11.09.08. And our original intent was we were going to remove these rates simultaneously when we passed the other regulation, but because there might be a small delay in when we submit our SIP revision and when EPA approves the SIP revision, we're not going to remove those right away until other revision.
Let's be very clear, because we have to be clear of this in our in any action we take. So I have the 10-1-14 draft in front of me.
Right.
Is this the one we're going to use? Would you like it?
Yeah.
So we're looking at the 10-1-14 version of the reg.
Diane. Okay, they already took that out.
Okay.
It's a separate page. What we did was we copied it as one page for the COMAR 2611-08. Okay. So these your deletions are going to remain.
And then we'll come back, and the intent would be come back and make an administrative change later.
Mm-hmm.
Is everyone okay with that approach?
So the new reg supersedes these rates, but these rates will remain as regulatory language.
Until we come back and change.
Yeah.
Is that what you were trying to describe?
Right. I don't like the word supersede. They'll run concurrent, but they're much higher than the reg we're passing right now. So they would not be in
effect.
That's
an important point of order that people have to understand. Good.
They're less stringent, so they're transparent, essentially.
Right.
Good. Nice way to say it. Any other thoughts or concerns? So I pushed Mr. Schoen on the spot before about moving forward. I would like to see another person make a comment about their suggestion for moving forward.
I'm happy to endorse the proposal as it was put forward to us.
Would you like to make a motion?
I so move that we just approve this amendment as it's written.
All right. All right. Any further discussion?
I guess I'll speak in favor of the motion as a minimally acceptable compromise, and that I see it. I mean, during the discussion, I saw a number of nods around the table that if this is weakened further in the regulatory process or in the litigation process, I think you'd get support for moving back to the 28th.
And to that point, we'll talk about four meetings scheduled for 2015, okay, later in the thing. So we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
I'm very much in favor of the compromise because I think taking out that flexibility and the opportunity to have one unit that might be very polluting, going off on days when we have high demand is not a good idea.
Great comment. Thank you. Any more comments? I'm going to go for a vote. That's why I'm trying to get anybody who wants to get their last word in. All in favor of the motion Anybody opposed? Anybody abstained? And then Sarah, are you on the line still?
Yes, I'm in favor.
All right, so thank you very much. That concludes that rule. Please travel safely, Dr. Aaron. So reminder where the exits are in the restrooms if you need it. We're going to move right into a briefing phase, and we're going to have a briefing on Section 111 of the Clean Air Act for power plants, and it's Ms. Franks is going to speak.
Section 111 has different approaches to whether you're a new source or an existing source. Section 111B applies to new sources, reconstructed sources, and modified sources. And basically, it's EPA's purview to just simply set standards for those types of sources. Because they do have this opportunity to build in the control technology, if there exists any, into their design, and they can achieve the limits. Section 111D is in regard to existing sources. And in that case, EPA establishes guidelines. And then it's up to the states to look at their individual sources and design programs to meet the standards that EPA establishes in the guidelines, but they can design those programs to meet whatever sources they have to get the needed reductions. So it makes often not as easy with existing sources. The President's directive requires that for existing sources, he wanted to have the guidelines from EPA proposed by June 1st, 2014. And amazingly enough, EPA did actually propose on time. They haven't done that for quite a while. So EPA's proposal actually ends up having four building blocks. They are to propose the best system of emission reductions that they think have been adequately demonstrated. And so EPA ended up with a set of four building blocks that were developed into rates for the states to meet. The building blocks are based on 2012 generation, and as I said, they create this framework of declining rates. They start in 2020, and they move through 2030. And the final rate, which you're to achieve in 2030, moves forward indefinitely into the future. States are expected to come up with a plan and send show that they are meeting these rates. And basically what they do is they form a glide path. This is where we are today in 2014, and these are the things that I'm going to do to get to where I'm supposed to be in 2020 through 2030. But EPA developed the rates using these four building blocks. And building block one actually, through a study done by Sargent and Lundy, EPA decided that existing coal plants could achieve about a 6% efficiency improvement. EPA did ask for comments on whether they thought 6% was achievable or whether they thought 4% was a better figure. We've worked with the coal sources here in Maryland, to see if any of these improvements have already been made and if they think these improvements are possible in the future. We haven't finished our negotiation with them, but even if you don't get a 6% reduction from coal sources within your state, it doesn't mean that you don't have to do anything for this building block. It just means that some of your other building blocks may have to do more. Building block two goes back and redistributes generation from coal and oil so that you move natural gas combined cycle plants up to a capacity factor of 70%, if this is possible. In some cases, either a state doesn't have any gas plants at all, like Kentucky, or like in the case of Massachusetts, they already have so much, they have a certain amount of nuclear, and they are already utilizing all of their natural gas combined cycle capacity so that they can't move up to 70%. So basically, there are some constraints on this building block, but in Maryland's case, we have one natural gas combined cycle plant, and it's about 270 megawatts. So EPA will take whatever generation we can expect from that plant if it were running at a 70% capacity, and it takes that away from coal, and then it calculates a new rate. So it calculates that rate of combined coal and gas. That's building block two. Building block three sets up a renewable goal for each of the states. And basically, what EPA did was they rather arbitrarily grouped states into about six regions across the country. And within your region, EPA looked at what your renewable portfolio standards were. So if you had a renewable portfolio standard of 25% and your neighboring state had a renewable portfolio standard of nothing because they didn't have one, then the average would be 12.5%. And EPA then applied that moving into the future as an average. It caused a lot of consternation. Many states are feeling that on one side that they didn't use goals that were stringent enough, and other states in general that don't have renewable portfolio standards feel that this is too stringent a goal. Building block four calculates energy efficiency targets. And again, EPA separated the states into three different groups based on how much energy efficiency the state is doing already. And once you are in your group, that requires you to have a certain percentage of energy efficiency and then increase that energy efficiency 1.5% per year. So those four building blocks were responsible for the rate that each state gets, both from 2020 on forward until 2030. And basically speaking, the renewable energy and the energy efficiency are the primary factors that are driving additional reductions once you get to 2020, moving into 2030. As you know, we are part of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and the Regional Greenhouse EPA was very good about taking comments before they ever proposed anything for this rule. And one of the things they did was they went to different stakeholder groups. They went to the power companies. They went to groups like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and they said, "What would you want to see in this rule? What are things you can live with? What are things that you think would be impossible to do?" And so we, as the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, went to EPA and gave them comments and said, what we would really like is we know that in general, under Section 111, you put forward rates, but you know that RGGI is a math-based program. We would like either to have you set up a rate-based and a mass-based program, or give us an easy way to convert the rate-based program into a mass-based program, because we would like RGGI to be the compliance mechanism that we use. It's already established. We think it's working well. So EPA did say in their proposal that states could convert the rate into a math-based target. And they put forward a whole TSD on it, which we thought was a little bit confusing. But they've asked for comment on this methodology, and they've gotten so much comment on this methodology that they are poised to come out with some additional guidance on how we're supposed to do this. In fact, many states have asked that EPA just go ahead and calculate math-based targets for all the states, because they're worried that with the flexibility that EPA has built in the rule, that there may be an opportunity for some states to game the system and get a less stringent math rate than they would have had if they just went ahead and did the rate-based standards. Okay. Maryland's 2012 rate is £2,158 of CO2 per megawatt hour. Maryland's 2030 rate under this rule would be £1,187 of CO2 per megawatt hour. So you can see that that's a very substantive reduction for Maryland to make. One of the things, aside from all the other things in the rule, is that there's been a lot of concern. You can see this is a map of the U.S., and it's color-coded with the types of reductions that the different states have been asked to make. And you can see here that all the states in green were asked to make a 20% or less reduction in their fossil rate here. That ends up being Maine, Kentucky, West Virginia. But you have other states, such as the red ones here, South Carolina, that have been asked to make a 45% reduction or more. So you can see there's a lot of different colors. There's a lot of different amounts of reduction that have to be made. And there have been a lot of comments that we would have liked to see this be a little more uniform in color. However, in going through my notes today, there seems to be an inside EPA article on Administrator McCarthy saying that maybe she would like less comments about how much equity there is in the rule. And really, it's a hard thing to say that just because you have a different percent reduction that it's easier or harder for you to reach the requirements of the rule. For some states, like Kentucky, for example, that where they have no gas whatsoever, it's that makes building block two almost ineffectual for them. But they may actually be able to make more of a reduction from their coal plants due to a lot of retirements, et cetera. So sometimes it's just not apparent by looking directly at the percentage reduction, the ease or the difficulty that you're going to have in making the rates. So I know that this was a very quick run through of the rule. The comment period on the rule has been extended even more than it was originally. And now you can submit comments on the rule until December the 1st. The rule itself is probably about 20 pages, but there's about 2,000 pages worth of technical support documents and backup information concerning the rule that's available online. You just need to go to Clean Power Plan. So if you have comments, I would encourage you to go ahead and write in your comments. The department will be sending in comments along with other members of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Overall, we're very supportive of the reg in the fact that, you know, we think it's time for some real reductions to be made for climate change and for us to have rules to do these things with. But we think that in some cases, EPA could have been a little more stringent for some of the other states that don't have to do quite as much as we have. So are there any questions or comments?
Great job. Two questions. One, do you know what, or can you explain to us what the rationale of EPA was to have different limits for each state? I mean, how did they arrive at one state versus another? That's my first question.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that everybody said to EPA in the time before they put this proposal out was, you know, please take into consideration the early actions that we've done because some of us are further ahead than other folks. And so I actually thought it was rather clever of EPA. There was a lot of comment also about whether or not all the reductions should actually occur within the fence line of the power plant just based on what they could do versus what if you would apply energy efficiency or renewable energy standards. And because there are no absolute reduction measures for CO2, that would have been very limited if it was within the fence line. So EPA came up with this equation with the four building blocks added together, which seemed to hit all the points that you would think would be involved in getting CO2 reductions by actually reducing demand and switching to renewable energy. And that just comes out to be different for each state because of where they start out. And as I said, what their actual fleet is. In states where you have a lot of nuclear generation, it may end up being a lot easier to reach the goals you're given. If you had a lot of natural gas combined cycle units and not too many coal units, but you kind of used all of them about 50%, having a lot of natural gas plants kind of works against you because it requires you to, it takes that generation and moves it away from coal. But without actually some sort of economic driver, like you have with RGGI, where you have a carbon price, it's not really apparent how you're going to drive moving from coal to natural gas if you don't have such a price.
Okay.
So.
So, I mean, did they take in the current pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour from each state into consideration? So the states that have deeper reductions presently are emitting more CO2?
Well, it doesn't really show up like that. If you look back at what I had about Maryland's starting rate is 2158, if you're just looking at the fossil units and everything, that's not a really stellar rate. But we have actually made already a 40% reduction under Reg. So if we've made a 40% reduction, but we still have this kind of a rate, you can see how it really is very difficult on a state-by-state basis to make this exactly equal without just saying, okay, you have to make a 30% reduction. And the way Section 111 is structured, it doesn't allow you to say that.
And my last question is in terms of methane emissions, you know, if we, from something like the President's plan, if we facilitate, you know, the switch to natural gas, which I realize, of course, is occurring economically without any legislation today, it's really important for EPA to understand CO2 equivalents and the methane that's not burned but released, because there's a tipping point where if you accidentally release methane along the way and don't burn it, it actually is worse for climate than burning coal. And there's a lot of debate about where the methane leaks occur and how fast they are, but what I hear from industry is that until there's federal regulation that they have to go after leaks, everyone has to go after leaks, no one's willing to do it. You know, getting the big leaks is obvious, and you go after them because you're losing money. Getting those small, really hard to find leaks is not economically viable for industry unless everyone has to do it. So I hope CO2 equivalents and methane leaks is built into what EPA eventually comes out with.
Well, the good part about Section 111 is that we can utilize it right now, but the restrictive part about it with respect to your comment is that it has to be sector specific. So what EPA would have to do is they would have to set up a sector that actually applies to drilling and the actual production of natural gas. And then they would be able to go after methane. But the way they've done it so far, and the way that the Clean Air Act limits them, is that they have to pick a source sector, and so they can't add a lot of that stuff in. As a matter of fact, as I hope that I said while I was talking, there are a lot of people that think this is actually too broad for what the Clean Air Act says under Section 111, that this best system of emission reductions shouldn't really include renewable energy. It should only be what is applicable to the power plants in your state. Somebody else? Yes.
Is there a date for that 1118 final rate?
2030. And EPA is hopeful that they can get this regulation final by June of 2015.
And I have another comment. It might be related to what Mr. Sauerwich just said. If the industry is thinking of replacing gas with coal, and gas on a short-term basis is many times worse, is there a consideration in the proposal?
So you want to replace gas with coal?
I don't personally, but that seems the movement to convert to gas instead of coal.
The only restriction so far is that you meet that end rate with your fossil fuels. So if you can do that with some combination, you can pick as much coal as you want and as much gas as you want. You don't have to switch, but you do in some way have to come up with the rate. So basically, you know, we could keep all the coal we have now and the gas too if we did a really bang up job with energy efficiency and renewable energy, because overall the fleet would be utilized less because you'd be using renewable energy more. So that's the flexibility of the way they wrote the rule. Does that help? Yeah.
So I heard what you said in the answer to the question about energy efficiency and switch to renewables, but if it came out that way, that in 2030, which is about 16 years from now, we have to go from 2158 to 1187. How would we achieve that in Maryland? What would be the tall poles that we would have to climb to make that happen?
Well, that'll be a future presentation when we get our plan all together. But, you know, I think 2030 is a long time away, and I think that's sort of a scary thought for everybody, because we don't usually think about things that are that far out. So you can have a lot of change in your fleet, and you do have to, by 2020, you have to get down to 1,500. So there will be some changes overall. And there are lots of things that are allowed. You can upgrade your nuclear plant, you can upgrade your hydro, you can add more renewable energy. We can go further with energy efficiency. And then there's a lot more gas, you know, that is set to come into Maryland. And what dynamic that will set up with the fleet that we already have is kind of unknown at this point.
Is the 1,500 by 2020 part of the EPA plan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ross,
they start giving you rates in 2020, and there's a different rate, a slightly lower rate each year until 2030.
Ross, it's important to recognize that the way EPA put this together, it sort of sets up state-by-state ways to do this, but it also provides for states to work together through regional processes to set regional goals that meet the state. And so as a REGI member, our plan is to continue to work through REGI to accomplish this. REGI has proven itself to be a very good, effective mechanism. And so we're doing all the analysis to figure out where REGI will take us, by when, and how it all plays out. But we clearly believe that the way to do this is through regional processes, and REGI has been a great example of how that can succeed. There's a lot of other support from other regions of the country that are looking at how a regional approach, given the way the energy markets work, seems to make a tremendous amount of sense. So, all for later.
And this was intended as a briefing. Any further questions? I want to move to the next item on the agenda, is to confirm meeting dates for next year. I know you haven't had much time to look at them. We've had incredible success by pre-planning our meetings a long time in the future. Any quick comments? Doesn't mean we can't come back after you get a better look at your calendar. But there's four. We have a meeting on December 8th. We're not moving that, but there's four meetings scheduled for 2015 that you'll see on the agenda, and you got an email about that also.
They're all Monday morning.
Yeah, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, they are. I checked the dates.
Yes.
All Monday morning.
All Mondays. And that seems to be useful to all of us to have a long-range planning time. Would we like to confirm those meetings? Can everyone just want to give me on the head nod? This is where we want to go. We don't need a motion. We don't need to do anything formal. Those are the meetings. As you know, sometimes there's a little change in meeting schedules, like we had an extra one today. But those are our meetings for 2015. I really want to thank staff. It helps me so much to have that. Any new business, anything we didn't cover, people want to bring up? Thanks for hanging in there. And what a great group of questions we had, and a great interaction on this rule. And your flexibility to have this extra meeting is a great service to this area. And with that, I adjourn the meeting. Be safe going home. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Sure.